You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
Before we start, I have a couple of housekeeping notes. The Second City has gone from stage to screen and really everything in between. Our live shows in Chicago will be resuming on May 7th with limited capacity in our main stage theater. Look for our other stages to open up in the coming weeks and months. We're also resuming some live in-person classes, corporate shows, and learning sessions. We continue to have virtual offerings in all these areas, as well as hybrid offerings. You can get all the information you need at secondcity.com.
Welcome to the world of Tony Ho from CBC Podcasts. It's an award-winning, bite-sized narrative comedy series about human relationships, familiar, hilarious, and sometimes unnerving. The troupe features Miguel Rivas, Adam Niebergall, and alumnus of the Second City main stage, Roger Bainbridge. They will take you on a darkly comedic ride that finds honesty in every situation. You can listen and subscribe to Tony Ho on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
I love this conversation. I love this book. And I really admire Sunil Gupta, who we're talking to today. He's an entrepreneur, the CEO of Rise, the health app, former head of product development at Groupon and Mozilla Labs. He was actually a former speechwriter for President Clinton. He teaches innovation at Harvard. And his book, which is called Backable, is an amazing story and other people's stories about what makes someone backable. And it's very unique and very improvisational. We ended up talking after we ended the interview. And I just really think you're going to enjoy the unique framing that comes from Sunil Gupta.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, seeking connections, and finding a better way. This is Getting to Yes And.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The car on the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
Sunil Gupta, welcome to the show.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me, Kelly.
In our field of improvisation, we begin our training by getting individuals to reframe their approach to failure and mistakes. We teach them that they have to make mistakes work for them. The author's note that begins your book starts with a failure. Can you talk to us about that?
Yeah, well, you know, for me, it was a string of failures. And I get a phone call from the organizers of a conference called FailCon, which literally stands for Failure Conference, asking me to be a keynote speaker at this conference. And it is a humbling experience when someone calls you and says, hey, we're doing this conference on failure, and we'd love for you to be the keynote speaker. I end up taking the gig, and I'm speaking, and I, you know, didn't know this at the time, but there was a reporter from the New York Times in the audience. And so, you know, fast forward to sitting in my apartment in San Francisco, and it's a Saturday, and the Saturday New York Times comes out, and there's this massive story on failure, and it's my face as up top of this article. And so, you know, for me, I think there are sort of two options. One is that you can kind of hide your head in the sand.
Yeah.
Or you can use that as a way to sort of, I think, break the ice with people. And, you know, I had been reaching out and cold calling people. At the time, I had started a company. It was going nowhere. People were not investing in it. I had been rejected by every investor that I had pitched, and I was trying to figure out what I was doing wrong. So I had been cold calling people for advice, and no one seemed to be responding. But I started to use this article as a way of saying, hey, as you can see from this link below, I don't know what I'm doing. would you be willing to grab a few minutes with me? And people just, they loved it. They, I think it was a sense of vulnerability to it. I think that they found it funny. And those conversations ended up paving the way to what ultimately became this book on how do you get people to take a chance on you.
It's interesting. My wife, who just got tenure yesterday at her college, she's a professor of comedy. Thank you. And she talks about the difference between improv and stand-up is that in improvisation, you're doing a lot of perspective taking from your audience. But in stand-up, you have to do perspective giving so the audience knows how to experience you. And that's a lot, if you think about people like Patton Oswalt and others, it's a lot of talking about the things that are wrong with them. So it is an opening of getting people to find a moment of connection. And I think it's like, it's a twin thing that is, you know, behavioral science shows us this, your experiences, and it exists in the world of comedy too.
Yeah, it's great. I love that. I love that.
You also have a story about a young woman who grows up near the border of India and Pakistan, who has a dream of becoming an engineer for the Ford Motor Company. And I found this to be just an incredible story. Do you mind telling that?
Yeah, you know, her story is really, I think, in a lot of ways, the basis for this book. One of the things that I've had a chance to do now for over 5 years is study people from these just fascinating sort of backgrounds, whether that be Oscar winning filmmakers to Michelin star chefs to military leaders to civic organizers, and just really understand what their process really is. But my favorite story by far is the one of a woman named Damayanti Hingirani, who was, spent most of her early childhood in a refugee camp on the border of Pakistan and India, no running water, no electricity, but somehow comes up with this dream to one day become an engineer with Ford Motor Company. Because at the time, Ford Motor Company was like the it company. That was the one company she'd really heard of. And so her parents get behind the dream. They save every penny they have to get her on a boat to the United States, where she ends up getting a scholarship to Oklahoma State University. And the day after she graduates, she drives to Detroit, Michigan, and starts knocking on doors, and finally finds her way into a meeting with the hiring manager at Ford Motor Company. But here was the problem. When the hiring manager looked at her resume and looked at her application, he said, "Are you applying for the job of an engineer?" And she said, "Yeah." And the hiring manager says, "Well, I'm sorry. We don't have any female engineers working here right now." Because, see, this was the 1960s. And while Ford Motor Company had thousands of engineers on staff, not a single one of them was a woman. Mm-hmm. And so Damayanti Hingirani is deflated in this moment. And she gets up and she picks up her resume. She picks up her purse and she begins to walk out of the room. And then in this last ditch moment, she turns around, looks this hiring manager in the eyes, and she tells him her story of all the struggle that had to go into her coming to this country, getting to Detroit, getting in this very room to apply for this very job. And this hiring manager is so moved by the story that, you know, this suburban white man from Michigan decides to take a chance on a refugee from the other side of the world. And Damayanti Hingirani becomes Ford Motor Company's first ever female engineer. Now, I love that story because it inherently changed things. It was this amazing backable moment that changed things not only for her, but for women in the workforce, for immigrants that were also hoping for a better day. And it is the basis for why I'm able to talk to you right now, Kelly, because Damayanti Hingirani is my mom.
It's the best. I told that story to a colleague today. And did the beat at the end and go, that was his mom. And she's like, I just got chills. And so much of this book is about the fact that human beings crave connection. We love stories. And so many, you know, so many people come to us, and especially in the virtual environments in which we're teaching right now, to be like, you know, how do I make myself a better storyteller? And it's like, I always interrogate that a little bit, like, okay, are you trying to persuade? Are you trying to network? What do you think you mean when you talk about storytelling? What it usually starts with is finding sort of that authentic moment of understanding who you are, faults and all. And you call this like basically convincing yourself first as a first step, right?
Yeah. You know, it was one thing that was really surprising to me is that I assumed that when I started to study these backable people, these are people who seem to have this it quality when they're inside a room, we really want to take a chance on them, that they were going to have a certain style of communication, meaning that they were going to speak, you know, with eye contact and hand gestures and pacing and all the things that maybe we think of when we think of like a Dale Carnegie course or a Toastmasters. But I did not find that to be the case at all. In fact, there were many, many backable people that I studied that had much more quiet, introverted characteristics. What I realized over time is that, you know, it's not charisma that makes us convincing. It's conviction. Mm. Backable people take the time to convince themselves first. And then they let that conviction shine through whatever style it is that feels most natural to them. And if you want a quick example of that, just go look up the number one most popular TED Talk of all time. It's a guy named Sir Ken Robinson who gives this just fascinating talk. It's just really, really wonderful. But it's a very un-TED-like presentation.
Yeah,
he has a hand in his pocket. He sort of has, he walks with a bit of a slouch. He ended up passing away recently, but he walks with a bit of a slouch. He meanders on and off script, and at the same time, it's a brilliant presentation. So it's not charisma; it is conviction.
And I think from some of the scientists we work with in our program at the University of Chicago talk about the power of the human voice. It's so much more powerful. And you know, Ken Robinson doesn't use any slides, and most of the top TED Talks aren't. They are a person talking to you with a compelling story that they believe in, and you get brought right back in. But you're right. There's no conformity to it. It's not like they're all like shucksters. They're very different. You also bring up Fred Rogers' famous speech that people know about when he was defending
PBS.
Yeah. It's not... He's not like a great orator, but
there's truth. And you can tell that like he has taken the time. He really believes. He believes. And if you don't believe, they can't believe. And I think Fred Rogers watching that video, you know, there's no doubt. Like, I mean, he's not using any of like the classic communication techniques, but he believes. He's 100% convicted that this is the right thing for the world, to greenlight PBS, to give it the funding it needs for the kids that he wants to communicate with. I mean, just take a look at Elon Musk, for example. I mean, when Elon Musk unveiled the future of SpaceX, Inc. magazine did an article, and the headline read, "Elon Musk fails public speaking 101," right? Look at Steve Jobs. You know, a lot of people sort of look back on him as a brilliant orator and communicator. And he gave some really powerful speeches. The Stanford speech was, the commencement speech was amazing. But go back and look at the 2007 original launch of the iPhone, the first time that he unveiled it. And that is seen as one of the more charismatic sort of presentations in the history of tech. But if you watch it, I don't see that. You know, I mean, the transcript alone, he uses the word over 80 times in that speech. He sort of is looking at his feet a lot. He's kind of meandering a little bit, but at the same time, it's a very powerful talk, again, because it is filled with personal conviction.
Yeah. There's a line in this first chapter that I have actually used this week like 7 or 8 times in various conversations. So I'm cripping from you big time. But it's that quote, "Most new ideas aren't killed inside conference rooms. They're killed inside hallways and break rooms."
Yeah.
So unpack, I have my own ideas, but tell us what you mean by that.
Yeah, I think we can all relate to a situation where we are with friends or with colleagues and all of a sudden inspiration strikes and we have an idea and we sort of blurt it out. And when we blurt it out, we sort of look around for everybody's reaction and we kind of realize like nobody seems to be as excited about this idea as you are. Mm-hmm. And so there's this deflating moment where I think a lot of people will then take the idea, put it in a mental drawer and sort of walk away from it.
Mm-hmm.
And what we found is that that happens all of the time. If you look at sort of, you know, one of the things I was most interested in is like, you know, backable is not just for celebrities. It's not just for CEOs. It's for all of us. So how do ideas within companies or within organizations get bubbled up? And what I found is that most ideas don't get killed inside formal situations. Mm-hmm. They don't get killed inside the pitch room or the conference room. Most great ideas get killed inside these casual hallway conversations where, again, we sort of blurt that idea out. And the reason that matters is because I think that what we found is that backable people learned over time to resist that temptation to just blurt the idea out right away. And they kind of do a little bit of a decision tree. Like they ask themselves in that moment, is this an idea that I have high conviction for?
Yeah.
And if the answer is yes, then by all means, share it in the moment because you'll be able to be prepared for that back and forth mm-hmm. that's probably going to happen. But if the answer is no, if it's more of a chocolate M&M where you can squeeze it and it cracks immediately versus a peanut M&M, then take what we call in the book incubation time, mm-hmm. quiet time, resist the temptation to share it in that moment. Take it back to your desk or your workspace and spend some time incubating it, nurturing it so that you can put a peanut inside.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is the whole philosophy around the yes and concept in improvisation is that people's default setting is to do nothing or say no. And so if your culture is basically like, no, you need to say yes and not stop at a yes, like build upon that idea. And I go back and you write in the book too, and this is so true of improv, like you shouldn't be afraid to let people put their fingerprints on your project, which I love that phrase, which is the same thing. It's like, we are co-creating this. No one is doing this by themselves. Steve Jobs didn't do that by himself. In fact, he didn't even come up with the idea. It was a guy in another company. So this is not how human beings are oriented emotionally. So, and this is one of the things I loved about the book is I just felt like I think your framing is so superb, and it just, you know, I'm always looking at it through a theatrical text, and that's how a lens, and that's how I think about it. But you provide this other kind of lens that is like, yeah, this isn't just about business. This is about, you know, your relationships, your life.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I love that. I love that, Kelly. I mean, you know, in the 1940s, Betty Crocker introduced instant cake mix to the market. And I love this story because like, they thought instant cake mix was just going to like erupt. They thought it was going to be this hit product. And they were stunned when they found that no one was buying this instant cake mix. So they get this psychologist named Ernest Dykta to go out into the field and figure out what's going on. And what Dykta does is he starts interviewing homemakers around the country. And he comes back with this really surprising conclusion. And the conclusion is that they had made the process of making a cake too easy. Mm-hmm. Too simple. They had removed the customer from the creative process. So Dykta's recommendation was, why not remove one ingredient from the mix and see what happens? And so they do. They remove the egg. So now as a customer, what you have to do is you have to crack and mix in your own fresh egg. And sales take off.
Yeah.
Because now when the cake comes out of the oven, the customer felt like they were really, there was a sense of ownership there. Like I felt like I made that cake. And it's just over and over again. And I know you see this in improv, like over and over again, we see these situations where we almost assume that creativity is a two-step formula. You come up with a great idea and you execute on it. But there's this hidden step in between. And that hidden step is where we flip outsiders into insiders. We make people feel like they are as much part of our idea as we are. And that way, when we show up to execution, like we show up together. And I think you could trace every great performance, every great organization, community initiative, political movement back to that hidden step.
Yeah. It is such an honor to be lampooned by The Simpsons. And when they took on Second City, it was that Homer was giving suggestions and then he wanted credit as a writer because he was co-creating the show with them. And I just found that funny, but it's so true in the sense of what we do is we sort of relentlessly practice in front of our audiences. Hey, I meant to ask you too, when you were at Groupon, were you there when it was like tons of improvisers were working there?
Yeah. Great. Like it was so much fun. I mean, ton of improvisers and people like Dan Jessup. I don't know if you,
I know Dan. Dan actually worked at Second City for a while, not too long ago.
Yeah, no, I used to come to Second City and check out their shows. So it was like this wild thing where it's like, you know, we're working on this business together. And then like after work and, you know, we're going to their shows. It's just, it was a lot of fun.
And you know, and I know Andrew a little bit, Andrew Mason, and I thought it was interesting there because when you're talking about the storytelling and understanding your character, that really you see sort of the, you know, the downfall of Andrew and his time there, as I think you say they lost focus of who the central character was.
Yeah. You know, when I first interviewed with Andrew, I was just so blown away because, you know, it wasn't the classic interview where we might like sit across a conference table from one another and like go down my resume. Instead, we literally walked around Chicago and he would point to these local mom and pop shops. And he was like, you know, let me tell you the story about that one over there. That person's a baker and they got into baking when they were, you know, a teenager. And this is what they want to do with their life. And like, he knew their stories. And it was just so clear that the company was built around this idea of like, hey, local mom and pop shops, like, let's let them focus on their craft. And let's try to help them in the other ways that they don't necessarily want to be spending their time on, like customer acquisition and all those other things. And it was such a beautiful mission built around a central character, the central character being, you know, the owner, the small business owner. And I remember I flew back to San Francisco. I told my wife, I don't care what other offers I get here. Like I'm going to work for them. Like I'm going to go work for Andrew. And that's the way that it was for the first couple of years, is just resolute focus on that one central character. But then, you know, we go public as a company and all of a sudden, you know, the pressures to start focusing on the bottom line, to start focusing on profit and quarterly earnings, all the things that we know happened. And we were no more resilient, I think, than any other company with our mission, where we said like, okay, well, let's start focusing on those numbers. And when we did, you know, we sort of lost focus on that mission. And I think that, you know, a lot of things happened as a result of that. I think in the long term, that was one of the reasons that Groupon, you know, underperformed. And I think you know, Andrew, you know, to his credit, was I think still very much on sort of the mission. Like he wanted to keep the focus on the central character, and when that wasn't sort of jiving with the quarterly earnings numbers, you know, I think the board took issue with that, and ultimately, you know, he was let go.
It's hard, right? You know, we're kicking around at Second City, you know, because we're essentially been down for a year and we've had complete overhaul. We have new owners as of like a week ago, who I like very much. And we're sort of like re-looking at what our purpose statement might be, which is not easy because you're looking for something sort of audaciously bold and not sort of connected to just the product or whatever. And we talk a lot about ensembles and collaboration. And the thing I've always felt was unique about Second City is we have a philosophy, an improv philosophy, which is all about making others look good, and we produce nothing but stars. And I've finally decided that those are not fighting each other. That's actually the thing that happens. And I think, you know, I don't know that most people would think that Evan Eschmeyer from Northwestern basketball would show up in a business book, but I think that's part of what I'm talking about is why you have him in the book.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting with Evan, I think of a lot about him, even in the context of Second City and Yes And, because like, you know, there are certain people who just end up having this like really collaborative effect on your lives. Mm-hmm. For Evan, you know, what I love about Evan Eschmeyer's story is that, you know, I self-proclaimed, he would say this if he were here too, like he was an NBA basketball player who, you know, was probably sort of at the bottom of the league. Like people did not know who he was. And then one day he gets a call from Mark Cuban saying, we want to recruit you to the Dallas Mavericks, which at that time was like a championship contender team. Mm-hmm. And he was baffled. And a lot of people were baffled and like, what is going on here? And as it turns out, Mark Cuban had started to do some numbers behind the scenes, but he was looking at a different metric than most recruiters or scouts or coaches were looking at. His number that he was looking at was, what was your plus minus? And what your plus minus is not how you were performing when you were on the court, but how did your team perform? Mm-hmm. How did the other four players perform when you were on the court? What happened to their performance? And what he found was that while Evan Eschemeyer as an individual had some of the lower numbers in the league, when it came to his plus minus, he was one of the top ranked centers in the league.
Yeah.
And so Mark Cuban and his team are like, we got to get this guy because he makes everybody around him better. And so they do, and they bring him on, and he gets to be part of this just amazing, you know, this amazing sort of program with, you know, really great players like Steve Nash and Dirk Nowitzki. And, you know, I got to be friends with Evan after that, and he became what I was stunned by is like that collaborative atmosphere ended up sort of playing off the court as well.
Yeah.
I can take ideas to him, and he's the person that's always, he's the quintessential yes and
right
person, right? Like, yeah. And like, and you could do this and you could do that. And yeah, and you could do this. Like, these are the people that you want to have in your life when you're coming up with ideas. It's funny, in the book, I talk about the four C's. Mm-hmm. And these are the four types of people that complete a backable circle, and collaborator is one of them. And that's Evan Eschemeyer.
I think the Phil Jackson dynasty Bulls teams also had a fair share of that, right? Cause I mean, Jordan was great before, great after, but when he had that, and I think it's not, I think the fact that Phil Jackson was interested in improvisation through a Grateful Dead lens, but still it's this very similar thing that we're talking about. And in the book, you tell this, that great Ella Fitzgerald story that's become sort of prophetic. So would you want to tell that one?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. So, you know, one of the concepts in the book that I feel just really passionate about and is that we must play exhibition matches mm-hmm. before we get into sort of the main event. Over and over again, what I found is that when we see people who seem to be kind of just naturally gifted inside a room, the overwhelming amount of the time it is the result of lots and lots of practice, but we often don't see those. And these exhibition matches, which are low stakes practice sessions before we get into the room. And these low stakes practice sessions tend to be pretty sloppy. But what I found is that backable people, they sort of have this mentality, which is that long-term success comes from short-term embarrassment.
Yeah.
And if we're going to embarrass ourselves, we might as well do it in front of friendly crowds, mm-hmm. low stakes moments before we get into something that feels like it's, you know, it's really going to matter. So, you know, these exhibition matches, what I was stunned by is how many exhibition matches a lot of these backable people will play. On average, I found that they played 21 exhibition matches, which mm-hmm. to me seems like overkill, right? Like it seems mm-hmm. like, well, if you're doing something that much, isn't it going to make you less natural on stage, or isn't it going to make you less natural inside a room? But what I found was it was the opposite. And this kind of brings us to Ella Fitzgerald, which is that when you have such a mastery of your material, such comfort of having done something so many times, what you can do is you can be so fully tuned in to the room, and you can be very adaptive to things that might go wrong. Right. So, and oftentimes they do. It's very rare that we go in and, like, you know, submit, you know, go down our resume inside an interview and then walk out of the room. Right. It's typically the tough questions that we are able to answer well that end up making these backable moments. For Ella Fitzgerald, she was singing Mack the Knife in Berlin. And it was a big moment because it was the first time that, like, a woman had really sung that song in front of a big audience. Frank Sinatra had sung it, and like a lot of the classic men had, but it wasn't, you know, she was the first woman. And in the middle of all that, some stuff was happening in the audience that caused her to lose her footing, and she lost her lines. And so now she's in this is being recorded, and she's a massive audience, and she doesn't know her lines. But on the spot, she's able to improvise the rest of the lyrics. She just keeps going, snapping her fingers, moving along, making up lyrics as she goes, and it's being recorded. She ends up winning a Grammy for that performance, for a performance that wasn't even the real lyrics, and it wasn't intended, But the reason, if you unpack that story, the reason that she was able to roll with that, the reason that she was able to sort of just recover so easily is because she had practiced so much, because she had spent so much time, that when she was caught in this really awkward moment that we all get find ourselves get caught in, when the projector goes out, we get interrupted, someone's rude, like we get caught flat-footed. It was the mastery and the repetitions in these exhibition matches that helped her steer it into an even better place.
I don't know if you know Tim Harford's book, Messy, but there's all these stories that are very similar, including the fact that Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech was improvised, the second half of that.
You
know, and Keith Jarrett, the famous jazz pianist, improvised the Cologne concert, which became, So all that stuff is just amazing. And so I talk about this all the time of because improvisation is a practice, and we have the two acts of scripted, third act that is improvised, which is where we're constantly sort of innovating and creating, which is why I think we produce so many amazing talent that goes out into the industry. And we have businesses where millions of dollars are on the line for salespeople. And how much practice do they do? Like none? I mean, not a lot. I think as a standard sort of industry, and it's like, I would think you'd be having a practice session pretty much every day, like you would get up and work out or do yoga or something of like, you know, how are you saying this? How are you talking about it? You don't know how to tell your story until you tell your story.
Totally. I completely tanked an interview with Jack Dorsey. I was so excited about this job. He had just, it was at his company Square, which is Twitter. And it was a product management job. And I had been, it's an e-commerce company, and I'd spent the past nearly 4 years working in e-commerce. So I felt qualified for it. And I completely messed up that interview. I couldn't answer any of his questions the right way. And, you know, years later, when I was writing this book, I sat down with a guy named Oren Jacob, who used to be the chief technology officer at Pixar, which, you know, Pixar is sort of in a lot of ways that the center of the backable universe, because you've got creative, you've got writing, you've got engineering, you have business, and they're all kind of colliding with each other in order to make these films. And there's a lot of tension in that process. And if you want to be successful inside Pixar, you really have to know how to rally people around you, which is something that Oren got really good at, and having spent nearly 20 years there. And so I tell him this Jack Dorsey story, and he asks me, how many times did you practice for that interview?
Yeah.
And I said, what do you mean? I'm like, I prepared. I did my research. I had notes. He's like, no, but how many times did you practice? And I'm like, I didn't practice. I don't practice for interviews. He's like, so let me get this straight. You know, he's like, you went to law school, right? And I'm like, yeah. He's like, did you do practice tests in law school before you went to an exam? I'm like, yeah, of course. I mean, you had to.
It was important.
You had to. Yeah, I definitely had to. And he's like, so for a law school test that, you know, who knows what kind of bearing that had on your career, but for a law school test, you did hours and hours of practice tests. But for an interview that could have changed the course of your career, you didn't practice at all? And it's like this just gut punch moment where it's like, gosh, I didn't practice. And in fact, there's been so many times in my career where I walked in these high stakes situations and I didn't practice at all.
Right.
Makes a huge, huge difference.
Yeah. I'm curious, like, you had that aha moment. Did that change then your habit, your practice habit?
Oh yeah. I mean, you know, and again, like, I find that this practice allows me to be fully tuned in. Like, Kelly, I feel like right now you and I are having like a really connected conversation. But I will tell you that, like, if you were interviewing me 3 months ago, what would probably be on my mind is, all right, here's what I'm going to say to Kelly. And then here's going to be the next thing I'm going to say to Kelly. And then here's the next thing. I would have a script in my head, and I would be attached to that script. But because I've been able to do this enough now, and I know my material, and I've practiced this enough, I think I'm able to have a much more natural conversation with you. Cause I'm not thinking about what I'm going to say next. I'm thinking about like being here with you.
Well, and I think the other thing is what the learning loop is that the educators talk about. So, which is you have your material, you sort of play with your material, and then you have to spitball it back. So I read the book, I underline the book, I'm holding up my notes, and I only consult my notes 3-4 times here because I'm listening to you and knowing, because I know enough of the stuff that I might want to hit back at. And yeah. I mean, it's like I use the term a lot, meaning is made in moments, and you want to have like rich moments with individuals. And you don't have that if you're not in improv. We say this, you need to play the scene you're in, not the scene you want to be in.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah.
Oh, I love that.
Just a true thing. Okay. So in a moment, I'm going to ask you for a yes and story. Before I do, I was quite moved by your story about Dr. George Schaller, I think I'm pronouncing that, who was a young biologist in the late 50s studying mountain gorillas in Central Africa. Tell this story and what made him different, because it's a very powerful metaphor.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I'm so glad that stood out to you, because it really stood out to me as well. Dr. George Schaller was one of the more famous primatologists of all time. So if you've ever watched a movie called Gorillas in the Mist, Sigourney Weaver plays a woman named Diane Fossey, and Diane Fossey is mentored by a guy named George Schaller. And, you know, in real life, Schaller did more for this field probably than anybody else. And part of the reason that he was so successful is because he was able to get much closer to gorillas than most people were ever able to. And one day he's at a conference and he's presenting his research. And finally, someone in the audience stands up and says, Dr. Schaller, like, why is it that these mountain gorillas are letting you in? Why are they letting you get so close? And Schaller responds, it's simple. I never carry a gun. Never carry a weapon with me. And Schaller's view was that while you can hide a gun in your backpack, you can never hide your attitude around a gun.
Yeah.
And the gorillas would always pick up on that. They'd always know, right? Yeah. It's so primal. It's so ingrained in us. And I have come to see now, after spending years writing this book, that our desire to impress other people, our desire to be perceived as the smartest person in the room, is the gun inside our backpack.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're doing it because we think we want to get a certain result, but what's really happening is that we're creating a sense of separation between ourselves and the people in the room. And like you say, it's the moments that really create the meaning. And if I think it's very, very hard to create those moments when we're trying to impress or try to be the smartest person in the room.
I was listening to a podcast the other day, and a person whose mentor was Elie Wiesel said that one of his North Stars was that he would never allow another human being to be humiliated in front of him.
Mm.
And I was like, that framing is a really powerful way to live your life, and requires you to live with a level of grace that I think would be, I mean, worthy, not just worthy, but I mean, like, would make everyone's lives better, including your own.
I love that.
Yeah.
I love that. Well, it reminds me a little bit of Larry David, because, you know, it's like
they've never been compared.
I know. It's funny though, because as prickly as Larry David can be, you know, like, the one thing I always notice and read about with him is that, like, when it comes to auditions,
mm-hmm.
when it comes to people auditioning for him, mm-hmm. he becomes a very generous person in those moments.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
You know, laughing along with them, building them up. And I always thought to myself, wow, that's a little bit of a mismatch. But it seems like he's adopted a little bit of that. I don't want anybody to feel humiliated in front of me.
Yeah, right. I mean, that's and so much of our work when we get people in the beginning improv classes is that unlearning of shame. Like, it's not useful. There's going to be fear, and we can help you with that. But the real thing that's going to kill you from your full creative self is any sort of shame attached to it, because you need to fail. You need to learn to fail and get back up and fail again and get back up and fail again.
Yeah.
And then as you get older too, there's a interesting evidence that my person I work with at the University of Chicago taught me, which is that if you become really good at something and you master it, and you just keep doing that, you tend to become less happy. But if you find adjacent expertise, that's where people sort of thrive. And that's why I always like am interested, because I love music and I think of like artists like Neil Young or Lou Reed or David Bowie, who are constantly experimenting when they maybe didn't need to. But I think it was a thing that drove them, and it was a source of sort of creative happiness.
No, I love that. Yeah, I mean, I know we're coming up on. You mentioned a yes and question, yeah. and maybe this will answer it, because okay. I do this little routine with my daughter. She's in second grade. And we do this mm-hmm. little routine before she starts school each day, and I ask her, "What is the meaning of life?" And she says, "To find your gift." Mm. And then I say, "Yeah, and what's the purpose of life?" And she says, "To give it away." The meaning of life is to find your gift, and the purpose of life is to give it away. And I think Backable is very much about how we give our gift away. But one of the things I found, and this is sort of the yes and versus something else, which is that I think there are three words that kind of cut against the yes and those three words are, I'm not ready. Right? I'm not ready to speak my mind. I'm not ready to step into that leadership role. I'm not ready to run with that idea. And the thing that I realized, if there was one common characteristic amongst all of the Backable people that I studied, it's that none of them were really ready.
Yeah.
Like three friends from design school were not ready to start Airbnb. A mid-level talent manager wasn't ready to go start SoulCycle. A 15-year-old from Stockholm, Sweden wasn't ready to build an environmental movement. And yet today, Greta Thunberg is Time Magazine's youngest person of the year. And there were setbacks and there were failures along the way, but they all seem to adopt this mantra, which is that the opposite of success is not failure, it's boredom.
That's a powerful statement, because you need to know what's on the other side of that thing to understand the good side. And the best people I've ever worked with at Second City were relentlessly curious.
Yes.
And they weren't ready. I mean, like, you know, when Tina Fey went to the writing staff at SNL, you know, and she's what, like 26 or 7 at the time, and then the next year becomes the head writer. You know, it was like, but she found herself there and then used all, I mean, that, and that story, as you point out, it's across industry, it's across arts, everything. Wow. All right. The book is called Backable. Sunil Gupta, thank you for coming on the show.
Kelly, thanks so much for having me. I'm a huge fan.
Getting the Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor and producer is LF Garris. We get support at the Second City from Jenny Crowley, Abby Bumbledare, Mike Farinaccio, and Colleen Fahey. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. If you have questions, guest ideas, or if you want more information on working with Second City Works, you can go to www.secondcityworks.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
survive.